The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated June 23, 2025. As usual, it is bordered in red on the front cover, with a narrow white inner border next to the red, behind which is a very dark, I'm going to say black, but it might actually be very dark gray background, with Time in large block capital lettering superimposed in gray. In the foreground, there's an orb. It's a silvery-looking orb, inside of which are layers of more silver, graphite color, gray, more orbs within orbs. Well, actually, they're semi-orbs, but within this nest of semi-orbs is a golden orb at the center. And the caption reads, "Are you human? Sam Altman wants to find out." That's on my list of articles to read to you, but it's at the bottom of the list. So I will proceed with the brief. Sneak Attack by Simon Schuster. Ukraine's audacious drone strikes deep inside Russia may announce a new era in warfare. There's a photo on the cover by Oleg Petrusyuk. There are apparently soldiers in the field at night. The backdrop is extremely dark, black, but the soldiers are lit in a soft red, and they're working on some kind of a contraption. I'm guessing it's a drone. If one looked at the arms of this contraption, which I'm calling a drone, and I don't know if it is or not, they would probably be the height of one of the men, one of the two men working on it. The man who's standing tall is wearing a light on his helmet, and it is emitting this red glow, and another man is bending over the contraption. The two individuals are standing on the ground, as is the piece of equipment. Turning the page, this is one page by Simon Schuster. The drone factory in Kiev had an enviable problem. It could make more combat drones than the Ukrainian military needs. The heavy ones, known as vampires, can be assembled at a rate of 4,000 per month, the factory's founder told me on a tour of the facility in March. The smaller ones, similar to the drones Ukraine used June 1 to attack several Russian air bases, could be made many times as fast, he said, roughly 4,000 per day. All around us, the noise of the production line made it difficult to hear, as did the speaker system playing 80s music. I just died in your arms tonight. So I asked the founder to repeat himself. 4,000 drones per day? Yeah, that's at full capacity, he said. Right now, we're only making around half that. The surprise attack June 1, targeting Russian military aircraft parked as far away as Irkutsk, more than 3,000 miles from Ukraine, employed a total of 117 kamikaze drones, according to President Volodymyr Zelensky. Each of them cost around $400 to produce, and they destroyed Russian bombers worth billions by Ukraine's count. That would make this operation, dubbed Spider's Web by Kiev, one of the most efficient dollar for dollar in the history of warfare. Some Kremlin propagandists even called it Russia's Pearl Harbor. That is a stretch. Thousands of Americans were killed in the Japanese surprise attack, December 7, 1941, while the June drone strikes against Russia did not cause any reported deaths. Ukraine's main spy agency, the SBU, claimed more than 40 Russian aircraft were damaged, about a third of the nation's strategic bomber fleet. Western estimates suggested roughly a dozen Russian planes. In any case, the SBU operatives behind the strike deserve to take a bow. They managed to sneak the drones into Russia, inside shipping containers, which were driven close to the air bases on commercial trucks. Once in position, the tops of the trucks popped open, allowing the drones to launch and fly toward their targets, feeding live footage of the strikes to their pilots back in Ukraine. Zelensky called it a brilliant operation that had taken some 18 months to prepare. Planning, organization, every detail was perfectly executed, he said. But as the Russian targets still smolder at their bases, military strategists around the world are already wrestling with what this strike means for the future of warfare. How will such weapons be used in other conflicts? How can any nation protect its most senior officials, even its heads of state, when a fleet of drones could be hiding in a truck next to their public events? For the moment, the drones Ukraine produces remain inside the country because the government has banned their export during the war. Once the war ends, those restrictions are likely to be lifted, and Ukrainian drones could appear on the global market in abundant supply. Last year, Ukraine produced more than 2 million combat drones of various types. This year, it's on the way to making twice that many. For Kyiv, the foreign market for these weapons is central to rebuilding and rearming after the war. One lawmaker estimated last year that drone sales could earn Ukrainian manufacturers some $20 billion, which could be reinvested into the domestic arms industry. The founder of the factory that Times visited in March told me he has already received purchase requests from European countries as well as Egypt, India, and Pakistan. They all know our drones work because they've been tested in actual combat, he says, asking not to be named for security reasons. Once these drones become widely available, governments around the world may need to rethink their military doctrines as well as their protocols for guarding state officials. Non-state actors have already shown their skills in drone warfare. With backing from Iran, the Houthi rebel group used drones to attack commercial ships last year in the Red Sea, disrupting global trade routes. The U.S. responded with a largely ineffective bombing campaign against Houthi positions. Our adversaries use $10,000 one-way drones that we shoot down with $2 million missiles, the commander of U.S. Special Operations Command, Army General Brian Fenton, told a congressional hearing in April. That cost-benefit curve is upside down. Ukraine has used this asymmetric advantage to great effect against Russia, but many in Kyiv see the long-term risks of the weapons they've unleashed. Last fall, an officer for Ukraine's military intelligence agency showed me a prototype for a new type of drone that had been used in numerous strikes inside Russia. It looked like a model airplane with an explosive shell attached to its belly, and the officer said it had a range of at least 1,000 miles. He was clearly proud of the ingenuity that went into the drone's development, but as an expert in security, he also wondered what would happen if these weapons end up in the wrong hands. Protecting military objects is going to get a lot harder, he told me. The usual strategies won't work. smoke show. This is a photograph with a caption. About a third of the page, maybe a bit more. Well, the sky in the background is bright blue. There's a mountain or hill in the foreground that's green on this side, and as one peers around the top, it turns to grayish brown. And then there's this huge plume of dark gray, brown, white smoke emitting from the top of this hill or mountain. A cloud of ash and smoke billows from Mount Etna in Sicily, Italy, June 2. Authorities said nearby residents were not at risk, but tourists were evacuated from the summit of the 11,000-foot volcano, known as one of the most active in Europe. Italian volcanologists said the plume rose from lava flows after a partial crater collapse. The Bulletin by Callum Sutherland. Boulder, Colorado. Attack highlights rising anti-Semitism. The firebombing of a rally in Boulder, Colorado, supporting the release of Israeli hostages held in Gaza, continued a surge in anti-Semitic incidents and hate crimes toward Jewish Americans. A dozen people were injured in the June 1 incident involving an improvised flamethrower. It came less than 2 weeks after two Israeli embassy employees were fatally shot outside the Capitol Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C. Suspects in both attacks shouted, "Free Palestine." Anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. skyrocketed 361% in the 3 months after the October 2023 start of the Israel-Hamas war, according to the Anti-Defamation League, ADL. In February, the American Jewish Committee reported that 33% of American Jews said they'd been the target of anti-Semitism, in person or virtually, at least once over the past year. In the same report, 56% of American Jews said they altered their behavior out of fear of anti-Semitism in 2024, up from 46% in 2023. A 2024 ADL survey found younger Americans were more likely to endorse anti-Jewish tropes. The highest rate was among millennials and the lowest among baby boomers. The rise of anti-Semitism coincides with both opposition to Israel's actions in Gaza and an increase in anti-Semitic hate speech being shared on social media platforms such as TikTok and Instagram, which tend to be more popular among young people. Some students turn to TikTok or Instagram influencers for their understanding of a really complex geopolitical situation, says Mark Oppenheimer, a professor of practice at Washington University. It's increasingly acceptable to talk about Jews in broadly stereotypical terms, as Joe Rogan does, as Kanye West does, as Trump has. At the same time, President Trump is accused of exploiting anti-Semitism by citing campus Gaza protests to justify massive funding cuts to specific universities. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and four other Jewish senators said Trump is using a real crisis as a pretext to attack people and institutions who do not agree with you. Turning the page to the brief news, good question. This is another two-column or one-page article. Why are 100-year storms happening so often? By Jeffrey Kluger. Climate change is leading not only to droughts, wildfires, and extreme weather, it's also leading to oxymorons, at least when it comes to what are known as 100-year storms, floods, and other events. Long-term weather forecasting is all about probabilities, factoring together not only current conditions and trends, but also the historical record. Environmental scientists have gotten so good at reading weather history that they can characterize some severe storms or floods as likely to occur in a given area only once in 100 years, or even 500 years, or 1,000 years. That's where the oxymoron comes in. As climate change leads to greater meteorological volatility, the events forecast to happen once in 100 or 500 or 1,000 years are occurring twice or three times or more in those windows. Since 1999, there have been 9 storms along the North Carolina coast that qualify as 100 or 1,000-year events. One study by the Montreal-based carbon removal project Deep Sky calculates the frequency of deadly hurricanes has jumped 300%, with 100-year storms now forecast to occur once every 25 years. Climate change is also redefining what qualifies as one of these rare and intense events. In April, an extreme rainfall event hit the Mississippi Valley, says climate scientist Andrew Pershing, chief program officer at Climate Central, an advocacy and communications group. The World Weather Attribution Group did a study and calculated it was a 100-year event based on today's climate. But without climate change, it would have been more like a 500-year event. Making those kinds of calculations can take some doing and a fair bit of data modeling, because climate unfolds over the course of millennia, and modern weather and climate records barely go back a century. Scientists first look at 30 years of data, 50 years of data, and figure out how frequently these events occur, says Pershing. The challenge is that when you do that, you're using data from the past, when it was around 2 degrees cooler than it is now. When you start to do the calculations for today's climate, you find events you expect to happen once every 100 years may happen once every 20 years. Driving the more frequent events is what Pershing describes as a thirstier atmosphere, one that's hotter and capable of holding more moisture. We have a supercharged water cycle, and that means that when you get a rain event, it has a better chance of being a bigger event, says Pershing. Some of those bigger events could be coming soon in the form of hurricanes. May 22, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, N-O-A-A, released its projections for storm severity in the 2025 Atlantic hurricane season, which runs from June 1 to November 30. NOAA did not attempt to predict 100 or 500 or 1,000-year events, but it does see trouble looming. The agency projects a 60% chance of an above-average hurricane season, a 30% chance of an average season, and just a 10% chance of below average. Across the 6 hurricane months, NOAA predicts 13 to 19 named storms with winds of 39 miles per hour or higher. Up to 5 of those could be major hurricanes, category 3, 4, or 5, and the impact could extend far beyond the coastal regions that are usually hardest hit. In addition to hurricanes, floods, and storms, heat waves, droughts, and wildfires also can be projected over centuries. A hotter atmosphere can hold more water, but if you squeeze the moisture out over a mountain range, like what happens in the West, then you end up with a much drier air mass, says Pershing. The atmosphere then wants to suck the moisture out of the ground. There's no easy fix for a feverish atmosphere. In the short run, adaptation dikes and levees to protect flood-prone cities, relocating residences away from eroding coasts can help. In the longer run, shutting off the greenhouse emissions that created the problem in the first place is the best bet for limiting 100-year storms to their 100-year timelines. We have to quit the use of fossil fuels as fast as we can, says Pershing. This will give the climate a chance to stabilize and us a chance to adjust. Here's the milestones page, starting with the died people who have their own columns. Died Sebastio Salgado, photographer and humanitarian. This is by Belinda Luscombe. Sebastio Salgado, 81, who died in Paris, May 23, took photographs that were too beautiful to look away from. This was key, since his subjects were often those which people did not want to see. Humans laboring in brutal conditions, families trying to find safe haven through hostile terrain, the decline of the environment. Born in Brazil in 1944, but exiled in 1969, Salgado, that's S-A-L-G-A-D-O, was college-trained in economics and self-trained in photography. He shot photos in more than 120 countries, capturing events as varied as the 1980s Ethiopian famine, the attempted assassination of President Ronald Reagan, and firefighters in Kuwait battling burning oil wells. He endured landmines, malaria, freezing temperatures, thousands of miles of barely walkable roads to get the images he wanted. His photos lured attention rather than begging it, mesmerizing while they messaged. The most famous, like those of Brazilian gold miners swarming up and down perilously rickety ladders, are equal parts astonishing and horrifying, a concerto of scale, light, and movement. His blacks are sooty and his whites luminous. Skies are marbled, landscapes vast. In the aftermath of documenting the Rwandan genocide in 1994, Salgado put down his camera for a season and founded the Instituto Terra with his wife Lelia Wanick Salgado, helping to reforest Brazil's Rio Doce Valley. This environment led him back to photography, and he captured the traditions of indigenous people. He lamented that critics said his work aesthetized tragedy, and that the injustices and vanishing natural wonders he documented so painstakingly led to very few changes. I am pessimistic about humankind, but optimistic about the planet, he told The Guardian in 2024. The planet will recover. It's becoming increasingly easier for the planet to eliminate us. There is a portrait of him. It's a photograph. It's of a bald gentleman with barely white facial hair, dressed in black, seated on a modernistic-looking stool, apparently surrounded by his own photographs in black and white, at least in this photo. One does see the luminescent whites and the sooty, smoky, gray blacks, and that's all I can describe from this angle of the photographer's lens. Another died with its own column, Phil Robertson, Duck Dynasty Patriarch. This is by Chad de Guzman. Duck Dynasty star Phil Robertson died at age 79, his family announced May 25, a few months after revealing he'd been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. The Louisiana-based college football player turned professional hunting entrepreneur in 1972, invented the Duck Commander, Duck Call, the namesake product of what became a multi-million dollar hunting gear company. The family expanded its business into media with a number of reality TV shows, most notably A&E's Duck Dynasty, which aired from 2012 to 2017 and is set for a revival focused on Robertson's son and his family, premiering this summer. Robertson was outspoken about his sometimes controversial Christian and conservative views, particularly on homosexuality and abortion. Fans, however, praised his dedication to his faith and how he lived unapologetically. And here's the column with only a few entries. Let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Starting with purchased the rights to Taylor Swift's first 6 albums by the singer after a years-long dispute over the ownership of her music. Swift announced the news May 30. Departed Elon Musk abruptly May 30 from his role leading the Department of Government Efficiency, which made controversial federal spending cuts. He later blasted the President Trump-backed domestic policy bill. Pardoned, convicted tax cheat Paul Wolczak by President Trump, April 23, less than 3 weeks after his mother attended a $1 million a plate Trump fundraiser, it was reported in May. Died, Jonathan Joss, J-O-S-S, the Parks and Recreation actor, who was shot and killed at 59, June 1. Despite his husband's claim it was a hate crime, police said there was no evidence indicating the murder was related to Joss's sexual orientation. Loretta Swit, S-W-I-T, the actor best known for her role as U.S. Army nurse Major Margaret Hot Lips Houlihan on the sitcom MASH, died May 30. She was 87. A new Hajj, H-A-J-J. This is a 2-page photo spread. Well, it's, I'm going to read the caption. In the foreground is the steeple of a mosque because it has the crescent atop it. And all around it in circles, it seems like never-ending circles around this facility, are people dressed in white. It's just mathematical and geometric and symmetrical. A new Hajj, Muslims gather at the Kaaba in Mecca, June 1, 3 days before the start of Hajj. This year, under a new rule imposed as an effort to reduce overcrowding, the expected 2 million pilgrims are barred from bringing children. Saudi officials also have tightened visa enforcement, deployed AI surveillance drones, and installed the world's largest cooling system in the Grand Mosque complex. In 2024, more than 1,300 people died amid temperatures that reached 116 degrees Fahrenheit, 47 degrees centigrade. The photograph is by Hazem Bader, or Bader, B-A-D-E-R. Here's the brief health. 5 Ways to Swim Safely This Summer by Angela Haupt. Okay, this isn't too long, but it shows some photographs of people dressed like mermaids floating on water and 2 little kids with their paddle boards ahead of them. That glistening swimming hole might look and feel refreshing on a sweltering day, but writhing in pain from stomach cramps, nausea, and vomiting, staring at the bathroom ceiling instead of the blue sunny sky, not so much. Jumping into even the prettiest and clearest rivers, lakes, creeks, and other natural bodies of water can expose you to a cesspool of unpleasant and invisible fellow swimmers, most commonly bacteria, viruses, and parasites. These germs are microscopic, so you're not going to be able to tell they are there, says Bill Sullivan, a professor of microbiology and immunology at Indiana University School of Medicine and author of Please to Meet Me, Genes, Germs, and Curious Forces That Make Us Who We Are. Swimming is a great fun activity, don't get me wrong, but you do need to be mindful. There are dangers that lurk out there. That is especially true for certain people. If you're mostly healthy, you'll fare better than some. If you're exposed to bacteria or other nefarious germs, your body should cover fairly successfully. The people most susceptible to severe illness are the very young, the very old, and those with pre-existing conditions that weaken their immune system, Sullivan says. If you're in one of those vulnerable populations, you should definitely reconsider swimming in questionable water. We asked experts how to stay safe from the threats that might be hiding in your favorite swimming hole. 1. Heed posted warnings. Take signs about swimming risks and possible contamination seriously. If somebody's taking the time to provide health guidance, it is worth listening to, says Dr. Daniel D. Rhodes, section head of microbiology at the Cleveland Clinic. Check local water quality reports and your destination's social media account. Some parks post warnings about the water, especially after severe storms or if there's been a sewage leak. 2. Use all of your senses. Most of the time, the water you're swimming in will not have any noticeable signs of what's lurking beneath. But if you detect a foul odor or notice a strange color, stay out. Discoloration could indicate there's a discharge from a pipe or a nearby golf course, says Rachel Noble, a professor in the Institute of Marine Science at the University of North Carolina. If you see a lot of cloudiness, or if a clear lake has spots covered with algae, then the likelihood is that there's some sort of runoff that's getting to that location, she says. The runoff can contain things that make you sick, so use your senses. 3. Pay attention to the weather. The risk of infection spikes in the aftermath of a storm. Heavy rain can wash all kinds of contaminants into the water. Dog waste from nearby paths, debris, chemicals, human sewage, more. It's impossible to say exactly how long the risk remains elevated, Noble says, because many factors influence it. But if you notice active runoff or rainwater flowing across the land into the water, it's best to stay on dry land. 4. Use earplugs and nose plugs. Wearing earplugs when you swim can help protect you from the bacteria that cause swimmer's ear. And nose plugs, sometimes called clips, act like a clamp for the outside of the nose, Sullivan says, which can block water from entering your nostrils. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends swimming with a nose clamp to help ward off serious infection. And the 5th, don't swim if you have open wounds. This can help protect you from necrotizing fasciitis, the flesh-eating bacteria sometimes lurking in salty or brackish water. You should also cover any cuts, scrapes, or fresh tattoos or piercings with a waterproof bandage, Sullivan advises. And watch where you're going. If there's a lot of rocks or shells and they cut you while you're swimming, the flesh-eating bacteria can get into your body that way. The View, Culture. So Long, Song of the Summer, by Taylor Crumpton. The idea of a pop monoculture has not only ceased to exist, but also resulted in the loss of shared cultural touchpoints that connect millions of Americans. A fragmented culture stands in its stead, thanks to the rise of the curated algorithm and social media feeds, perfectly sculpted to fit our interests and experiences. Yes, this has made us more, or at least feel more, disconnected. But is that so bad? Crumpton, the author, is a music, pop culture, and politics writer from Dallas. Perhaps in the absence of so-called meritocracy that once dictated culture, this abundance of choice for people to connect with music and pop culture could be a good thing. Maybe that's why the Song of the Summer feels like such a dinosaur. We have simply grown out of it. In 2010, when Billboard created the Songs of the Summer chart, it explained a song's place was determined by its cumulative performance on the weekly streaming, airplay, and sales-based Hot 100 chart from Memorial Day through Labor Day. This made sense, given the time. In 2010, Facebook was the most popular social media platform. The first-generation iPad had just been made available to the public, and California Girls by Katy Perry was the number one song on the inaugural Song of the Summer chart. That song was everywhere. You could not escape it. Fast forward to 2024. And the Billboard Song of the Summer was I Had Some Help by Post Malone featuring Morgan Wallen. The top placement seems to be at odds with Brat Summer, the meteoric rise of Chappell Roan, the bubblegum pop of Sabrina Carpenter, the historic rap beef of Drake and Kendrick Lamar, all of which betrays the chart's inability to encapsulate the music people are actually listening to. This is partly because of TikTok, which has completely changed the way music streaming and a song's popularity operates, and their data tell a different story. On TikTok's U.S. summer charts, Tinashe, Blood Orange, Eon, Lay Blanks, Banks, Glorilla, featuring Megan Thee Stallion, and Jordan Adetunji, held the coveted top spots, a list that reflects how vastly the concept of the Song of the Summer has changed. Americans, rather than being homogeneous music consumers, are shifting toward personalized music experiences and playlists. For emergent artists, this is a double-edged sword. They're now utilizing data from social media platforms to shape and develop how they connect with their audiences. But the unintended consequences of personalization include fewer access points for artists to connect with new fans unless they find their way onto a listener's algorithmic playlists. Consider that in the 1990s and 2000s, artists might be exposed to a larger audience via song placement on a prominent movie soundtrack or a guest appearance on a popular television show. The advent of streaming has narrowed that pipeline for musicians. The only artists to claim the worldwide dominance and control over music and pop culture that symbolizes any semblance of a monoculture are Beyoncé and Taylor Swift. In 2023, the Renaissance World Tour and the Eras Tour generated billions of dollars. Throughout their respective decades-long careers, both women have appeared on film and TV and music video programs, performed at televised award shows, released chart-topping songs that, yes, defined a summer. Yet in a multicultural world where consumers and listeners are curating their own experiences, there's no longer a need for uniformity. Back in 1999, music critic Ann Powers described Songs of the Summer in the New York Times. The singles that blare forth from car radios or boomboxes in parks and at the beach are the catcalls of a nation baring its collective skin. With the pop scene in a giddy, fast-moving mood, such quickly fading shout-outs seem more resonant than usual. But America's collective is not homogeneous, so how can one song feel right to all of us? The only thing that connects Americans during the summer is the weather. The sunshine breeds an incessant need for a beach or proximity to a pool. Produce demands a picnic in the park with a sandwich, chips, and a pickle. The nonstop waves of heat usher in short shorts and bikini tops. Young Americans declare their independence from school, while the employed are looking up the nearest happy hour. These are the experiences that connect us. Maybe it's the right of every American to dictate what song feels right to them, and maybe sharing your respective summer songs with others is the connection point that America actually needs. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. New stability and a swing left in South Korean election result. South Korea's election delivered a resounding triumph for Lee Jae-myung. The first name is L-E-E space J-A-E hyphen M-Y-U-N-G, the veteran center-left leader of the Democratic Party of Korea, DP. His victory, June 3, closes a tumultuous chapter in South Korea's politics, marked by former President Yoon Suk-yeol's short-lived declaration of martial law, impeachment, and removal from office. It also ushers in a left-leaning administration with wide latitude to govern and sets the stage for a dramatic reorientation of the country's domestic and foreign policy. Lee takes office with a rare advantage in South Korea's often fractious politics, a unified government. The DP holds a majority in the National Assembly until at least 2028, when legislative elections are due, giving Lee power to enact his agenda without the checks and gridlock that stymied his predecessor. Though he campaigned on a centrist message to broaden his appeal, Lee's margin of victory will allow him to claim a strong political mandate and govern as a progressive. A populist shaped by his years as a labor and human rights lawyer, Lee has long advocated for a stronger state role in redistributing economic gains and curbing corporate power. While structural changes such as sweeping corporate reform face institutional resistance, his administration will push for increased social welfare spending, higher taxes on corporations and the wealthy, and tighter oversight of big business. It will take Lee weeks to form his cabinet, and his administration will not unveil a detailed policy platform until mid-August. In the meantime, he must stabilize an economy under pressure from weak domestic demand, falling exports, and the threat of higher U.S. tariffs. U.S.-South Korea trade talks will be Lee's first test. The Trump administration's 90-day tariff pause expires July 9, at which point they will rise from 10% to 25% unless there is a new trade deal. Lee has adopted a cautious tone, signaling he may seek a deadline extension to allow him to benchmark South Korea's deal against those being negotiated by Japan and others. If talks falter, South Korea, whose second largest export market after China is the U.S., would face major headwinds in Lee's efforts to stimulate growth. Foreign policy is another arena where Lee will chart a distinct course. He has pledged to maintain South Korea's core alliances, but his record suggests a cooler posture toward Washington and Tokyo and a pivot toward Beijing and Pyongyang. Lee criticized his predecessor's overtures to Japan as overly subservient and is skeptical of any deeper trilateral security cooperation that binds South Korea more closely to the U.S.-Japan alliance. A friendlier approach to China, which Beijing is all too happy to encourage, would further strain ties with Washington. At the same time, Lee has expressed openness to restarting talks with North Korea and wants to avoid Seoul's being sidelined if Donald Trump revives his own outreach to Kim Jong-un. But Kim's renunciation of reunification last year and deepening ties with Russia limit expectations for diplomacy. Still, engagement with Pyongyang is one of the few areas where Lee and the U.S. president could find common ground. After 3 years of divided government, institutional clashes, episodic crises, South Korea has now taken a sharp left turn, driven by a president who has the mandate, the parliamentary majority, and the political will to deliver it. His presidency will mark the most cohesive governing era South Korea has seen in years, and possibly the most transformative. If Lee can deliver on even part of his agenda, he will reshape the contours of the country's politics and its place in the world for years to come. The Brief by Jeffrey Kluger, Editor-at-Large. Something strange is going on 15,000 light-years from Earth. Out at that distant remove somewhere in the constellation Scutum, an unexplained body is semaphoring into space, blinking in both X-ray and radio frequencies once every 44 minutes in a way never seen by astronomers before. The object could be a white dwarf, an Earth-size husk that remains after a star has exhausted its nuclear fuel. Or not, it could also be a magnetar, a neutron star with an exceedingly powerful magnetic field, unless it's not that either. Astronomers have looked at countless stars with all kinds of telescopes, and we've never seen one that acts this way, said astronomer Si-Teng Wang of Curtin University in Australia after the release of a paper he co-authored in Nature. It's thrilling to see a new type of behavior for stars. ASKAP, A-S-K-A-P, space, J1832, the star's technical handle, is by no means unique in the universe in sending out energy in steady flashes. Pulsars, rapidly spinning neutron stars, do too, but pulsars flash much faster than ASKAP J1832 does, in milliseconds to seconds. In 2022, astronomers discovered a type of object known as a long-period transient, which, like ASKAP J1832, sends out flashes of radio waves on the order of tens of minutes. So far, 10 such bodies have been found, but none identical to ASKAP J1832, which is the first to emit X-rays, too. Finding a mystery like this isn't frustrating, said co-author Tong Bao of the Italian National Institute for Astrophysics. It's what makes science exciting. Time CO2 Leadership Report by Justin Warland, senior correspondent. This rather short article may be a bridge. Look through the new five-year outlook from the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, and you will not see the UN Atmospheric Science Body use the words emergency or disaster. And yet it would be hard for anyone, even semi-literate in the science of climate change, to flip through it without a sense of urgency and alarm. The report finds that global temperatures will continue at or near record levels, with a possibility that the temperature rise since the Industrial Revolution nears 2 degrees centigrade by 2030. Already, warming momentarily breached 1.5 degrees centigrade in 2024. It is a big marker. Decades ago, policymakers settled on 2 degrees centigrade as an ideal cap of sorts. That's because at some point between 1.5 degrees centigrade and 2 degrees centigrade, we might expect to begin seeing climate effects that are both dire and, perhaps more important, irreversible. The WMO report reaffirms the world has entered that danger zone, and the risks posed by the planet's warming are on the verge of growing dramatically. The increasingly dire atmospheric reality, underscored by this new report, might lead to some urgent calls for companies to cut their emissions. Indeed, reducing emissions is the only way to keep the problem from getting worse. But our temperature rise trajectory should also push companies to take a hard look at how prepared they are for the changes that will come on the road to 2 degrees centigrade, not decades from now, but in the next 5 years. We are in a climate emergency, and the situation worsens every year. Sonia I. Senavirotne, a professor at the Institute for Atmospheric and Climate Science of the ETH Zurich, told me earlier this year, it is not necessarily making the headlines, because there are also many other crises, but we should not forget it. The WMO report outlines a number of alarming predictions for the next half decade. For the summer season in the Northern Hemisphere, temperatures are expected to exceed averages in previous decades almost everywhere. In the Arctic during the northern winter season, the temperature anomaly is likely to be more than 3.5 times as large as the global anomaly, and sea ice is expected to continue to decline across the Arctic. Between 1.5 degrees centigrade and 2 degrees centigrade, heat waves become more frequent and intense. According to the UN's climate science body, crop yields decline, coral reefs may be wiped out completely, infrastructure faces increased flood and fire risk, demand for air conditioning will stretch electric utilities thin. Farmers and agriculture companies face not only crop losses, but also declining worker productivity in the heat and other extreme weather. All of this adds up to a massive headwind, poised to slow economic growth. A 2021 report from Swiss reinsurance giant Swiss Re found that 2% centigrade of warming would lead to global GDP that is 11% lower by mid-century. While a growing number of firms are disclosing the risks posed to their business by the physical effects of climate change, even the most forward-thinking firms find it impossible to fully understand what these hotter temperatures will bring, and therefore what can be done to prepare. With each fraction of a degree global temperatures rise, the further we get into uncharted territory. Climate deniers use uncertainty to argue we should slow our efforts to reduce emissions. Why should we spend trillions to address something we do not fully understand? But the present uncertainty is pretty frightening on its own terms. Health Matters by Alana Samuels, senior correspondent, this will be abridged. As Congress eyes sweeping cuts to Medicaid, the health care program for low-income adults that serves about 20% of people living in the U.S., a new study has a sharp conclusion. Cuts to Medicaid will cost lives. The study, published by the National Bureau of Economic Research May 5, tracked nearly 40 million people who gained Medicaid through state-based expansions under the Affordable Care Act from 2010 to 2022. It found that during that time, Medicaid expansions increased enrollment and reduced members' risk of death by 2.5%. People who enrolled in Medicaid because they gained eligibility saw a 20% reduction in their risk of death when compared with people in states who could not access Medicaid. Medicaid expansion saved about 27,400 lives from 2010 to 2022, according to the study. It might seem obvious that expanding access to health insurance will improve people's health, but academics have had a difficult time proving this, says Dartmouth economics professor Angela Wise, co-author with University of Chicago economics professor Bruce D. Meyer. This study really does a lot to advance our understanding of the magnitude of this relationship between health insurance and this really important health outcome, Wise said. I feel pretty confident in saying that restricting Medicaid access is going to have the real human cost of having more people die than otherwise would have, Wise says. The last article was slightly abridged because we have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.